That was terrible. Edit it out. No.
And that's where we start. Hello and welcome to the Social iPod, everyone.
And so then I was like on the ground and I was just like screaming. I was like, ah!
I have theories. And I'm like, is that like first date goals?
Y'all can't see me, but I'm sitting in a relatively dark room, which is what I prefer. So.
Welcome all to the Social Eye Podcast, sociologists taking on big and small issues and making the political personal. I'm Wynn, they, them pronouns.
I'm Winona, she, her pronouns.
I am Iris, they or she pronouns.
And I'm Michelle, and the pronouns most comfortable to me are they and them. Wow.
Yay!
Yay!
Go team!
I am Wynn. I am genderqueer and non-binary, and that is why I use they, them pronouns. I am a Taurus moon. No, I'm a Taurus sun. A Leo moon and a Sagittarius rising. And I often find that memes related to my signs do pretty regularly fit my personality, even though I have some skepticism.
I'm really glad you said that because it's such a wonderful segue. Because I have been skeptical of my signs for most of the time I've been aware of them. I am a Sun Aries, and then I had to pull up CoStar just now because it doesn't matter how many times I've read this like dozens and dozens and dozens of times that I still can't remember my moon or rising, which tells you the extent to which they resonate with me. But it's a moon Libra and a rising Sagittarius, which I guess makes sense when people explain their read on that to me, but then I can't help but feel like they're just like filling in the blanks with what they already know about me. But like the Aries thing feels real after a very long road to it. I feel like I had to grow into being a ram that had butted my way through things. That's not something that came naturally as a kid. Iris, what about you?
I am a Scorpio sun, and then I have a Sag moon and a Cancer rising. There's a whole lot of depthy water with all the feels and some fire that comes out and creates a bit of steam sometimes. And, it resonates for me pretty well. I'm pretty scorpionic. Y'all can't see me, but I'm sitting in a relatively dark room, which is what I prefer. So, yeah, I do embody a lot of the Scorpio dark academia witchy vibe.
I
So
get
relate to that too. The sun just came out today after snowing for the last 2 days, and the blinds went shut
it.
immediately.
Yes.
I'm the opposite. The sun gives me life, and I need it. I'm living in Ohio right now, and it is like one of the worst places for seasonal affective disorder, and it slaps, as the kids say. But I know I'm supposed to prep this, but I felt like it would be disingenuous because, so I'm an Aries. I know that for sure, because who doesn't know their like first sign these days, right? But I have an aversion to like social trends, and I maybe that's the sociologist in me, maybe it's a little something more, but
Sociologist.
I've been told so many times, especially since my partner is like very knowledgeable about astrology and very into it, and he's told me time and time again, like,
Of
I
course.
cannot tell you though what my sun, moon, rising, I know one of them is like supposed to be the first one. Because I have that skepticism when y'all were talking, I was like, I'm not gonna be too far off what y'all think. But yeah, no, it's just when I was younger, I was just like flippantly like, oh yeah, whatever. But more so like actually trying to give good thought to it. I find it interesting as like a science. My sister bought me an astrology book because I'm curious about it. But the way that I first engaged with it and like mostly interacted with it was like on social media and these things that seemed like they could be applied to anyone. And it just very much so seemed like pseudoscientific a lot and just people using it for whatever they wanted to use it. So it didn't feel like it actually had a lot of meaning. I'm very like meaning driven. So I just personally haven't given it too much of my brain yet, but I am curious what, astrology is all about. But I'm curious about the science of it. And then it would
I
be
feel
interesting sociologically, to connect that to then how it plays out in the social world.
very similarly. And not me in the back of my head being like, well, that this is so very Aries of us to not know the other signs. I have theories. Because there's something to the time of year that you're born, and then people that are born around that same time are going to be spending, you know, the first months of their life indoors or outdoors, or times of the year that we're more or less likely to be around other people. And then generationally too, your generation then has all of these factors. So are we feeling some sort of gravitational pull from the alignment of the stars and planets? Or is it that these are, what is the word, correlational but not causational? Because here's the thing. So I said I'm a Taurus sun. I love being in bed. I love being comfy to like a really strong degree. I do think that I have a pretty stable personality. I don't think I'm stubborn, but people close to me have said otherwise. So,
So real.
so again, I'm like, maybe there's something to being born in the middle of May and spending the first few months of my life being comfy. I don't know. That's my theory.
I've definitely thought about the first one of like when we're born and when we're celebrated then as like in totally different times of the year. So like I love spring, and when I was a kid, it was mostly because my birthday's in the spring, but I just love the rebirth of everything after a winter. I feel like it definitely has something to do with also being celebrated then, because like if you're a summer birthday, big ol' summer bash. But then there's the thing of like you don't get celebrated in school, so that's gotta do something to the personality a little bit too.
Yeah, 100%. I love that. We're living organisms, right? We live according to seasons, regardless of what modern life broadly define how it shapes our life according to rhythms that are very much not organic, yada yada sociology. Nevertheless, that truth of being creatures that evolved on this earth and its many cycles and patterns is true. And I think astrology can speak to that. Maybe there is something about like the way gravity cycles and has patterns in the solar system to that as well that we just don't understand yet. I can imagine a lot of folks, because of the stigma in like more serious scientific circles, what tend to avoid looking at these things seriously. It's similar with paranormal investigation. It's this fringe, or almost cult thing, but it's not like humanity just started observing and making general sense of our world in the last 300 years, starting in the West. Ugh, problematic assumptions there, alert. And there's probably some wisdom that goes a bit further back that we can continue to learn from today.
Yeah, you got me thinking about like indigenous wisdoms and ancient wisdoms and how we're like so alienated from like our humanity right now. And like then because of post-colonization and right the westernization of the world and whatnot. But at the same time, that's why it feels superficial to me a lot of times, like the whole like conversation or you know talk around our like signs and stuff like that, because it feels maybe disconnected. But that's why too I don't want to be just like write it off entirely, because I know there's a lot that I don't know.
100%.
We are all sociologists. That is how we all know each other. What? So, what brought you all to sociology?
I found sociology in undergrad. It was my first semester of undergrad, but I think what brought me to sociology started well before then. So I grew up in Boise, Idaho, and very like homogenous culture, very conservative, and it's increasingly becoming so. So I grew up there, and there was a lot of sameness, but I experienced a lot of difference growing up. And we were very money poor. A lot of my younger childhood was spent living with my grandma in a house without electricity, and that was not like uncommon with other people in my family. And because of that, I think we had like a very queer family structure. Not something that I really would like termed it back then or really understood. But in hindsight, right, we had one of my grandma's, not biologically related, but my grandma's best friend who was really like the caregiver. She was disabled. And so having a disabled woman as a matriarch, I think really like kind of shaped how I understood the world from a young age. But then I became really aware of like class and gender differences, like around puberty. And I went to, you know, your average elementary school, but when I started getting into junior high, interacting with more people from different parts of the city, and then first, like, really meeting people who came from wealth and were of like higher classes, and getting to experience like what their life was like, seeing the different things that they did in their homes, the different ways that their parents treated them, right? I internalized like some classism at a young age because I saw that, and then I like wanted that to be the normal of my family, long story short. For instance, I came home one time, early teens, and made my family dinner and made us sit around the table for dinner because I was like, this is what's normal, right? This is what families are supposed to do, right? I don't believe that now. So, like, things like that, I would like bring home and start instituting in my house because I like observed it in other places. And then along the lines, I became a bit more critical and understanding of what this all meant. But from those younger years, I started just kind of questioning, like, I'm seeing these differences, but I didn't understand what made people really behave the way they did, not in like a psychological component, like, because I noticed certain people acted differently, had different realities. And so I was interested in that and I just kind of like started noticing it. But then I didn't have any education around that necessarily. And it wasn't until undergrad, I was undecided and I took an intro to sociology class, not knowing what it was at all. And I had one of my favorite professors of all time teach that class. And it just made sense from like day one, the way that she was talking about the world and like these different things, how it's organized and how socialization is a thing. And we learn different things depending on our upbringing. And I was like, yeah, this is it. And I was like, this is what's got my interest the most. And I pursued that throughout. And then fortunate to find McNair and got into grad school for it. And here we are.
Amazing. So this is Iris here, y'all. And I grew up, as it turns out, somewhere that is culturally and somewhat geographically in proximity to what Michelle described, only a much smaller town. So really tiny town. We were essentially in poverty. We were the family that people would come and drop boxes off on the doorstep and things like that. Wrong side of the tracks, so to speak, just all that kind of stuff. And large family and part of a cult, essentially. A very large, well-known cult, but that's what it was for sure. And so I'm a little bit older than the rest of the crew here, and so I didn't have access to anything that gave me the vocabulary, the concepts, or anything, not only to talk about being queer and trans and things like that, but to even self-conceptualize, let alone self-actualize those things. So all I felt was just that I was really weird and kind of broken and something was wrong with me, and I had no idea why. Like, I just felt super out of place. So if that doesn't steer you towards sociology, I don't know what does. Because basically, I felt like a little alien that had been somehow dropped off on planet Earth. And I was just like, where am I? What is going on? I just always felt like I was on the outside of a glass dome, kind of peering through it, watching the world happen, and just felt honestly quite disconnected, which there's also some kind of PTSD stuff and whatnot in there too. But yeah, things just always felt very strange to me. There was the strangeness in the familiar, right? Which is the sociological lens. And then in my undergrad, I met a couple of people that were sociologists, and they're like, "Oh my gosh, you're a sociologist. Like, you should do that." I'm like, "What is that?" And then I started my undergrad, and I studied sexuality, gender, and queer studies. And a lot of the folks that we read happened to be sociologists, and I was just like, "Oh, this is amazing!" And so that's really when I formally was like, "I want to do that." And yeah, so that brought me to sociology and wanting to just better understand myself, my place in society, and then try to work with incredible folks like y'all and others to get information out there that maybe helps others make more sense of this very strange planet that we're on. So yeah, that's it.
There's a lot in both of what you just said that resonates with me. And so, like, I'm trans, I'm a trans woman. This is a very trans podcast, FYI, if you, the listener, couldn't get a sense of that already. So, yay be warned and yay be very welcome. I think to be trans, to be inherently at one, the core of oneself outside of the system, regardless of where you're brought up, but especially when you're brought up in somewhere that's very politically reactionary or like culturally does not have a place for who you are, so to say. There's kind of an intuition for me that came with that, that I think is often a common experience among friends and loved ones. For me, famously made an analogy through the Matrix movies as a trans allegory. With dysphoria, there's this sense that everything's kind of wrong and you don't fit in it, and take the pill, and then you get to see the world for as it is and find a place in it that is one of resistance, rebellion, and hopefully revolutionary. That's something that's long resonated with me, and it's a big part of why I'm here. I also grew up in a similar area. I grew up in the suburbs of Salt Lake City, farming town turned suburb, settled by the Mormons, a place that was a culturally, let's say, not a kind place for a little queer kid to grow up in ways that sounds very similar to the two of you. It was mostly intuitive, but it was always kind of there. Like, I found a lot of expression through identifying as an anarchist as a teenager and like through radical music, through punk and hardcore and metal and stuff like that. And it very quickly kind of became a political journey for me. When I was still a kid, I could not wrap my head around why the US was invading Iraq for the second time when it was wildly unpopular, and got involved in like movement work through anti-war politics as I got older. I encountered sociology first in a high school social studies class. I enjoyed it, but it didn't really resonate to the point I wanted to make it core to my life just yet. And then in college, I started to learn more of the tools that sort of aligned with the place I had already put myself on the political left. And, you know, contrary to the right-wing stereotypes, it's kind of rare to actually encounter Marxism in US academia, but I did. At least in my neck of the woods, that is rare. And getting more involved with stuff, aligning myself more with environmental movements, I ended up finding Marxist ecology within sociology. That very quickly became sort of my theoretical home, and I sought that out for my graduate work. So now, being in sociology, having it been fundamental to how I understand my place in the world and how I would like to change it, I feel very motivated to contributing to that intellectual work and to sharing the same critical thinking and other tools that have helped me free myself. It wasn't guaranteed I was going to encounter them, wasn't guaranteed I was going to actively take part towards liberation and all senses of that. And I am very motivated by sharing it.
So well put.
I love that you noted, like, all of us are trans. We also, if it's not obvious, don't actually know each other that well. We are getting to know each other through this podcast, and that is kind of beautiful because there's part of each of your stories that I'm like, oh, I have that. It's kind of lovely. I grew up in sort of a weird lower working class. Like, part of my childhood was in poverty, and then part of my childhood was kind of stable, and my family was wealthy enough to buy a home at a particular point, but not wealthy enough to afford food regularly. There was just different things that happened. So, like, I definitely had like that like class consciousness really early on. And my school, there was a handful of really poor students, and it was really obvious, and then some really rich students and a lot of middle class. Again, like something that was really obvious to me and made me feel like a bit of an outsider. Also grew up in a cult-like religion, and the message at church was always, you are an outsider. And then at a certain point, being assigned female at birth, there was a lot of things that were unattainable for me at that church, things that I felt were unfair to be unattainable. So I just started to get sort of a gender feminist consciousness in my high school years, and then started to get a work consciousness. I lived in a smallish town that was predominantly white, and we had like a minor tech industry. And so, like, I had a paid internship after school in high school. So, like, I had this like privilege, but I started to see again, like, all these assumptions about like my capacity and what work should look like. So, I started to have these like experiences. And then I took a sociology class in my community college, and I was like, oh my God, this is it. This explains it. And I want to say, I actually got a C in that class. When I have students that get lower grades, I'm just like, don't worry about it,
Literally, I love that.
especially early on, because it's like it just meant that I had a lot going on and I wasn't quite fully engaged at the moment. So
100%.
I just started to get really into it with wanting to understand that gender and work and trying to understand myself and why I felt like an alien and like I was always a problem everywhere. The bull in me, that Taurus being a little bit stubborn of like, don't tell me what I can't do. So yeah, I just love hearing like a little bit of like, oh, and somehow I also ended up just meeting Marxist people who were like really questioning these systems along the way, who were really influential in introducing me to like theories and giving me that like framework to be critical, which was something I know not everyone has.
I love that you said that because so it like seems counterintuitive, but I did my undergrad at Boise State University, and it was like my plan Z school. I'm sorry for the fans out there, but I grew up in Boise, and like everyone was about it. And I'm telling you, I had this aversion to social trends since I was like young. We were really poor, and I was like, I want to get out of Idaho so bad. So yeah, I tried to go to other schools, but I didn't know how the college system worked back then, being a first-gen student. And long story short, ended up going to Boise State University. But I was also very fortunate to have mentors, instructors there that also really encouraged us to be critical. We had a research lab dedicated to critiquing neoliberal higher education, which was like infamous at university, right? And
Incredible.
so yeah. And I really went into it, and I came out of undergrad thinking that all sociologists were these really forward-thinking, aware
Literally,
people.
yeah.
Then found out that that is not the reality. We have a lot of positivists out there. Yeah, so I felt, yeah, very privileged in that sense too. And very counterintuitive again, because I feel like I wouldn't have guessed that that's what the sociology department at Boise State was like. But it was like very small, intimate, and yeah, it was very encouraging of critical thought.
Yeah. So many folks I talk to who are on similar trajectories to us, and I'm noting common threads for all of us, despite coming from a lot of different places. It's having those like educators and those teachers and those mentors who are able to kind of help us along, combined with the grit of being a ram of some sort and or another animal that likes to batter doors down and or each other down with antlers or horns or what have you. Again, for organisms. Anyways, yeah, very much relate to that. And I think it's a really important aspect of this line of work and why we're here talking about it. And also why we're doing it in this manner where we're not in the classroom with all the opportunities and constraints that that provides. At least speaking for myself, I want to share this knowledge and help share the knowledge of others far smarter and more knowledgeable than me to a much wider audience that may not have the privilege, the opportunity to attend the classroom or may not end up in the right one, right? I think that we all have a right and a stake in our liberation, and I want to share those tools as wide as we can. Here, here.
That makes me think of my own critical consciousness was really fired up when I read Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And that was within the context of thinking about teaching and thinking about learning and education through dialogue. And that is part of why I'm really pleased that there's four of us here. We can actually have a full-on dialogue between multiple people with these different life experiences, but some similar threads so that we can have common ground by learning from each other. That's how I approach my teaching too. It's exhausting, but so worth it. I think, as you were talking, Winona, made me think of teaching in particular. We are constantly learning from each other through our conversations, and this is just one way to do that.
100%. Yeah. I'm glad you brought up Freire or Freire. Freire. Yeah. My whiteness is showing my being from Utah, but also very influential for me, incorporating very intentional and hopefully liberatory dialogue practices into teaching, recognizing that in many ways, the learner, the oppressed person in Freire's framework, right, is bringing just as much, if not more, and certainly as valuable knowledge to the learning process. And it is through dialogue work that we can do that. And it's obviously not explicitly quite the same as standpoint theory per se, although they have things in common. But nevertheless, one's standpoint, one's position in the world, where one's come from, their experiences, stuff like that, is all valid and legitimate knowledge that I am very motivated in my teaching to help provide the skills, the tools, the critical thinking, the knowledge about these larger systemic processes, structures, forces in society to make sense of it in a way that is empowering. This is maybe my fault that the conversation got steered so much for teaching, but that is the number one reason I'm in the game. I love the research work I get to do, what I get to contribute to with a lot of humility, but that's definitely a number two priority for me. Yeah, I want to share what was shared with me. I'd say in terms of my own teaching practices, number one, in addition to Freire, is probably Lev Vygotsky's notion of the zone of proximal development, the ZPD, which is something that lives in child psychology and developmental psychology, actually, I want to say a lot. Not my wheelhouse.
spouse, but fundamentally boils out to getting a sense of where someone is and helping them take the next steps on their growth journey, however relevant to teaching, right? That zone of proximal development is in between where one is and where one wants to go in terms of their education. And given where they're at, how far can we move someone along and myself in kind? And so I try to teach in a manner that is centering folks' lived experience, their knowledge, get a sense of where they're at in terms of the work we're doing in my classroom, and how do we get to the next step is the priority.
I love it. I'm just so happy listening to y'all talk about your teaching too. I'm so excited to read Pedagogy of the Oppressed. It's literally in my book bag, but I haven't cracked it open yet. And I'm so excited even more now that y'all were talking, but it's really interesting how the notes I took on my approach to teaching seems to be close in line with that. And that's probably because I grew up knowing certain oppressions. And like what I wrote down is like my teaching is very like I try to make it as non-hierarchical as possible, centering students' experiences as valuable data. If you will, having them apply these teachings of sociology to what they've actually experienced, because that's what's going to stick with them. Especially if teaching an intro class where you know that majority of the students aren't going to be sociology majors, you just want to at least get them to think a little bit more critically and become a little bit more aware beyond your classroom. And then beyond that, just being very interactive and very conversational. Like, even when I quote unquote lecture, it's not a straight up lecture because that's just not my style. But when I do, it's very much so like, let me get your input at every step of the way because I know that I don't know everything. And I think it's really good to admit that to students too. And when you don't know something, to like use your resources to figure it out because that's what they've got to do. But I really love the idea too. That you bring up, Winona, of the zone of proximal development, and I wrote it down. And thinking, yeah, like meeting people where they are, essentially, right? Which is something that's so important. And so, like, I like to implement sometimes like these informal questionnaires at the beginning of classes to just see, like, what do you know about sociology? Or, like, if it's gender class, like, what does gender mean to you? And then, like, revisiting it at the end of the class and being like, okay, now what are your thoughts and ideas around this? And seeing that growth is really cool. Yeah. And then just be trying to be as personal as possible, personable, personal when getting to know students, because I know for me that that was so valuable. I mean, in my teaching philosophy, I talk about like seeing the unseen, which is like a kind of almost like a double entendre, sociologically speaking. But I was a student who went like largely unnoticed throughout the majority of my schooling until that English teacher in like my junior year, you know, how it goes for queer kids often. So for a long time, I mean, I was like pretty decent at school and you know, so I continued because it was almost expected of me because that's like I was good at it. I wasn't like a star necessarily, but I think largely because like I was not noticed by a lot of my teachers. I was able to just kind of like fly under the radar for whatever reasons, you know? And so trying to see all of my students for who they are, or at least like who they're showing me they are, and trying to make them feel special in the classroom and in the academy and pointing out as often as possible that the academy university is here in America, it's not set up for you to thrive. It is not. And so like, how can I help you thrive in this system that's not set up for you to do so, especially if you're a multiply marginalized student? Just letting them know like I see them and I'm a real human. And like I'm very informal, I think, because of my upbringing. So I let them decide what they're gonna call me, but it's never Mix Fretwell or anything like that. It's just like, call me Michelle, you know, unless you're not comfortable with that and you wanna call me something else. Teach is one I really like, but I love y'all's perspective. And Iris, I'm excited to hear about your teaching.
Thank you, y'all. That was a lot of gorgeousness. Yes, I am definitely learning some things from y'all that I want to incorporate. For me, I think that my time teaching in the classroom is deeply informed by the fact that I am a first-gen non-traditional transfer student. So I've attended three different community colleges before I finally settled into my bachelor's program and then went on to master's and beyond. But that experience really affected me a lot. lot. And growing up in a home where college was never even mentioned, I'm fifth of the kids in my family, and none of my older siblings went to school. So it was just like, it was something like, oh, we don't do that. That's totally off limits to us. No one at school even talked about it because they were like, oh, you're from that family. Yeah, we won't bother telling you about college. It's like kind of how it was. So I definitely approach the classroom with a lot of humility. Just to give where I'm at right now, I am academic professional. I'm not like a full-time faculty, but I am teaching courses that are meant to help students bridge from high school into university. And so it's things around just making sure that they feel like they are in the right place, that they belong. And it's really pitched as college success skills, but for me, it's truly more of every time I'm like, you're amazing, you belong here, we all benefit from having you here. And I tell them too, I'm a student as well. Like, I'm taking X number of classes this term. So I share that with them. I share struggles. And I tell them, I'm like, I am learning from you, and we're all learning from each other. So, like, let's show up for each other. And like, I go in with my plan for the day. But if they're all in the zone of connecting with each other and making friendships or talking about the concepts that we're studying or the podcast we listen to or the video we watched or whatever, I stop looking at the clock and I'm like, I'm just gonna let this go. Because if they can feel like they are grounded on this campus and in this community and are starting to make social connections, but also intellectual connections, to me, that's the best thing we can do. So I just try to focus on the welcoming and belonging, the genuine, not like the PR and marketing concept of that a lot of universities engage in, but like truly, you belong here. You earned it. And also all the resources here. So many students, you do college, like I use Photoshop, which is where like they engage with about 5% of what's available. So you try to share all the resources, and I'm like, y'all are paying for this. Like, it's yours. Don't like go plead for it. Don't ask for it. Like, take it. It's yours. Please engage with all the richness that this institution has to offer you. So that's really kind of the focus of where I'm at. But then certainly meeting people where they are and so forth. And just so they don't end up feeling overwhelmed, just be like, hey, you're good. Wherever you are, you're good. Like, we're a community. We've got you. And then just like learn together. And I always learn so much from my students. It's just, I never forget. It's a tremendous privilege to be in the classroom with them. As my colleagues, even though I'm in the position of power and I can't change that fact, but they're my colleagues.
100%. We are trusted with this position for whatever reason, and what we do with it matters. It's there either way. I aspire to it being beneficial for everyone in the room. I also worked, well, a similar role, not exactly the same. I was in a position for a couple of years where I was an advisor, among other things. I advised students on some academic programming I was the administrator over, and that was the best part of the job. Easy. Being able to work with students on a one-on-one basis is something that I miss quite a bit now, working as a graduate instructor.
I actually, as you all were talking, there was a couple of things that stood out to me. We all try to listen to our students, and our own personal experiences inform our desire to make our classrooms like really successful. That is also part of what has really benefited me with teaching and has allowed me to adapt. I don't know how many of you have all been teaching over the last like 4 to 5 years with students who were high schoolers when the pandemic happened. There's just been this shift in student needs. So it's that thing of having that personal experience, but like my personal experience just tells me that that people need somebody to care about like what their experience is, no matter what that is, and like to sit down and listen to them and not to like get jaded over time. As I don't want to like go too much on a rant. I was
Rant,
just talking.
rant, rant. That's kind of, isn't podcasting just going on rants?
Yeah.
Find
Well,
an audience for it?
tell me if this,
Sorry.
if I or go too long, but I was just talking to somebody in my department whose expertise is in death, right? And we were just having this conversation about teaching in particular, not about death, but like she brought up that she always gets frustrated when other faculty complain about students' grandparents dying. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, do they not remember what I was like to be like 18 to 22? And the fact that at that age, if you think about like your parents are probably in their 40s to 50s, their parents are in their 60s, maybe their 70s.
Or older.
And that's the, I'm sorry to tell you, but that's the time that people start dying. And like, that's just such a common experience. And then it's going to happen multiple times because you have a classroom of 30 to up to 70 students. I don't know if you have larger classes, but like, you're going to have multiple students every year and it's going to keep happening. And then I also brought up that one of the other things to consider is that particularly white culture does not have strong rituals around death. And
Absolutely.
we have this expectation that you handle grief privately and it shouldn't affect your schoolwork, especially grandparents. But different cultures, which we have a much more diverse student body across the board, different cultures have different family rituals around death. And so for students who are not white, they may have a stronger sense of responsibility to their family to go and go through the grieving rituals. And even for our white students, there are a lot of folks who want to try to reclaim the ability to grieve. So these like different assumptions. So I just work really hard to trust students to believe their stories. Who knows how many of students have lied to me, but I personally don't think I've had a lot of students who are being dishonest because I actually give them grace when they're honest.
Yes, that's what I was gonna
Right.
say. Yeah, if you're not
Yep.
pun yeah, if you're not punitive with them, there is no reason for them to lie about that, right? I have the problem where students will try to over justify their and not in a way that they're lying, but they like want to show me like doctor's notes and all of this stuff, and it's like,
Right,
look,
right.
like at the college, especially what we're dealing with, like college age folks, like you're an adult and you're learning, you know, how to be in this world, and like, right, you're gonna have days where you just like can't come in, you can't show up, that's okay, right? And just encouraging my students to be real about that and being real myself, right? And so they think that like I pride myself on being able to like cultivate good rapport with my students and like that mutual trust. And so yeah, if like students aren't going to go to the extreme of lying about a family member dying if you aren't going to punish them for having to miss class. Ultimately, it's their education, it's their learning. And if you encourage that learning, they're gonna wanna show up. They're not gonna have to
Yep.
go to that extreme measure.
It's amazing how much just like relationship building is central to all of this and just being real as human beings. Again, in institutions that tend to talk a big game, that is a PR game. The academic version of we're a family here. And I feel like as someone as queer who's also a sociologist, I'm like, bet, all right, let's practice this like chosen family as best we can, given the institutional constraints.
I almost want to dedicate like an entire episode to talking about teaching and pedagogy and all
We should.
100.
Yeah, absolutely. Should we talk about research?
That is the other thing, huh? There is that too.
As academics, that's our life is research, teaching, and writing, I guess.
We are all now officially graduate students, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So not only is it fundamental to the work generally, but that's like such a huge part of the PhD experience is like learning the craft, as my advisor puts it. And it is learning a craft, right? Having to like publish, 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 publish in order to be competitive on the job market and have a shot, right?
I can dive in. Well, I just figured I'd go because mine, I don't. I have a feeling mine might be a little atypical from maybe y'all's experience, but then we're learning that we all have a lot of diverse experiences. So, but yeah, so for me, like I think I mentioned that, you know, in undergrad, I studied sexuality, gender, and queer studies. I just had some incredible instructors. And so I actually did some really deep research at that time on the early modern European witch hunts. You know, I tied it to the transatlantic slave trade and genocide and land theft in the Americas and the overlap in the players involved in all three of those horrors, as well as kind of the things that were at play there, right? Like patriarchy, Christo-fascism, slash, you know, religious zealotry, certainly racism, you know, in the case of some of those. And of course there was ageism, ableism, all that kind of stuff. So a lot of that came into play. So that was really interesting to do that. It was like a year and a half long project. And then in my master's, I actually focused more on the theory and practice of how adults learn. So it wasn't strictly sociologically focused. So when y'all are talking about pedagogy and teaching and whatnot, it was a lot of that. So that was super cool. So, I didn't do any deep research per se. I did around alternative learning assessment methods was kind of my primary project for that. And that was fascinating. And, right now I'm primarily focused on the sociology of higher education and again on making it accessible and on learning assessments such as formative assessment and whatnot, because I'm involved at our institution with learning assessment quite deeply, including working with our students who are registered with our Disability Resource Center. And I just see how so many of the ways that we assess student learning is not great for anybody at all. And of course, it's especially bad for students with various disabilities and other life experiences and whatnot. So yeah, that's kind of an area for me is sociology of higher ed and alternative forms of learning assessment that are more around assessment for learning rather than high stakes assessment of learning, so that your assessment of learning is in the flow and part of helping students learn, so that it's not this terrifying high stakes situation, but more this just kind of in the flow of how they learn.
Very
I
cool.
think that's all I'd say there about that.
Can we do an episode on you talking about that? Because I want to learn everything you know and find out about that.
Absolutely. I think that's going to be true probably for each of us. I'm going to be like, ooh, I just want more and more and more of that from each of you.
I can. Yeah, I'll go next. So I've always been, I am a person, but I've always been a person of like many different tastes and differences.
Sorry.
What? I've always been a person? Is that what you're laughing at? I've always been a person for as long as I've known. I've been a human in a body.
Yeah, I've just been an alien, but I think I still have
They tell me I'm a person.
personhood. You are.
One of many different tastes and differences, interests is what I meant to write down there. But I haven't said this yet, but I'm non-binary. And so I feel like that honestly is in my orientation to the world. I remember having to choose, and it still happens every time, having to choose what I'm going to research here and there. It's like, I have so many interests. How the hell am I supposed to choose one? What? But I've had to here and
Real.
there. And so my first independent research project, right after the one on neoliberal higher education for an undergrad, my McNair research was on criminalization. I grew up also having many family members, if not most of them, interact with the criminal justice and the carceral system, rather criminal punishment system. And so I was interested more so in the social aspect of criminalization, what does that do to the criminalized, right? And I found out this will be so quick, but I found out through the literature that it was the most successful people who have been incarcerated are those who go into higher education. And so I was like, interesting. So these are supposed to be our most successful
Fascinating.
people who have been, right? Our most successful, quote unquote, in our society, right? So they're able to better job attainment, better this and this. And so I was interested. I was like, okay, so I'll use this as who I'm going essentially to study, who are going to be my participants, my respondents, what have you. And I found out it was actually rather difficult to get participants because it's a hard stigma, right? And it's one that's concealable. And so what I found is because I only ended up getting four participants because I used snowball sampling. I had a few people that had self-identified, or I got my mentor was like, I know a student, right? But they had to have self-identified. And then I think I got one person through snowball sampling potentially. And I was like, man, am I just doing research wrong? And then it turns out that year I read something that was really similar to the work that I was doing, but in education. And they also had a four-person qualitative study. And I was like, okay, so this is a thing. And it's because it's a hard stigma to have to deal with. And we can easily conceal it because it doesn't have any benefit within higher education, right? So why would you bring that up? And not that it should be that way. But yeah, so it really focused on stigma and stuff like that. So the stigma of criminalization is something that I've continued to do work in. But when I got to grad school, I wanted to do gender and sexuality work because I like that is where a keen fascination of mine is. But I almost was kind of pushed in a different direction. And so for my master's, I kind of went back to the criminalization stuff, but also focused on whiteness a little bit and media. And so how media influences our ideas about criminalness. Like, who is a criminal? Who does these criminal things, right? And with centering whiteness, because I looked at, like, I did a secondary data analysis from these, like, college students, and I focused on what the white college students thought, because the way that the data was conducted, or the way that the study was conducted, is that the data was largely white. So it's like, okay, what do these white college students think? And turns out that they thought, like, Black people and Latina people, they thought that they were more criminal, essentially, throughout, like, the measures that they used. And right, we know that, right, the racial stereotyping of crime and all of that stuff. And so, yeah, that's where a lot of my big interest was. But then I did an entire 180 for my comps and now my dissertation. And I study gender broadly, particularly gender as a social structure, but also more specifically, like, the non-binary experience of gender. And so I set forth with my dissertation to study. It was really like an exploratory descriptive study, because there's not a lot of sociological research on non-binary people, and not a lot of research, especially that considers overlapping systems of oppression, like racialization and ability, or ableism rather, and all that. So doing, like, an intersectional queer study of the non-binary experience, and it was also, in a way, using visuals, having participants, we did an interview, then they submitted photos and captions based on, like, a prompt, and then we did follow-up interviews where I got to do photo elicitation, like, what does this mean to you? What was it like to create the photo? And right, how does it make you feel? All of that good stuff. And really incredible experience to do that, because at the same time, I'm, like, going on my own gender journey, and I get to be in community. Like, came at it in a very, like, feminist or queer way of, like, having dialogue in interviews rather than, like, let me just mine you for data. I'm gonna then go get a dissertation and hopefully reap the rewards from there, kind of like trying to decolonize the research process a little bit. And yeah, so in non-binary identification, expression, joy, and my dissertation is, like, kind of shaping out to be about identify or being non-binary, identifying non-binary, and presenting non-binary, and what social factors and structures all influence the way one is able to do so, to do all of that, right? And coming to, like, a theory of resonance with gender, which I could geek out about for a while, so I'll kind of, like, stop here. But just understanding us as, like, human beings and such unique creatures, each one of us, and feeling resonance with different things. Like, we have overcomplicated the idea of gender much too much, and, like, as it's felt, right? So yeah, that is, I will say, my main research area.
Love it.
That's so fascinating. I can't wait for your episode too. Yeah, selfishly, teach me all the things. Like a theory of gender that centers resonance is so fascinating to me and something I feel like I know nothing about. That's really
But you
cool.
probably actually really do. Because
That's
as
like,
trans
yeah.
folks, we are gender experts. We are organic intellectuals in so many ways.
Speaking of that pedagogy of the oppressed. oh, that's so cool. Yeah, totally. Yeah, there's a lot in that I resonated with. I could talk a little bit more about mine. Another thing that you said that resonated with me was not wanting to pick one thing and doing that. You know, that's a big reason of why I'm here as well, because I like to do what I like to follow my hyperfixation, so to say, my fascinations. And sociology is, in terms of academia, at least a really good home for that. And, you know, as a discipline, I think provides us ways to dig at a lot of different topics. And but also I dance outside of sociology all the time because that's also being a sociologist and that's also having my brain worms. But I'd say first and foremost, I'm an environmental sociologist as well as which I approach primarily through like a lens of political economy, right? I mentioned Marxist ecology earlier, which is one of the more prominent ways to go about that. But you know, looking at the socioecology of X, Y, or Z, given people, place, what have you. How is it that we relate to our environments as human beings at a systems level, at a social level, at the level of ecosystems is something that I find fascinating and is very dear to me. And I think speaks to a lot of my interests at the same time. A lot of us are from the Western United States, right? And so we all have lived experience about how the natural world on this entire planet is dying. This is a planet that is being killed by the way we organize society. And that is very evidently true in the American and West, I think. When I was a kid, I remember getting about four times as much snow on the ground as we used to. And that's very much mirrored. And it's here in the Western US, at least in Utah, almost all of our water comes from snowfall in the wintertime. And it's mirrored in the summer by summers that are just defined by wildfire smoke as our forests burn, right? Which was also something that happened when I was a kid, but it wasn't definitional. It wasn't like most days were filled with wildfire haze here in the West. And so I don't know, getting into and actually being able to understand those dynamics is very dear to me personally. I mentioned that I grew up in the suburbs of Salt Lake City. One of those dear sort of natural systems will say to me is the Great Salt Lake, right? And it is currently dying as well. It is drying up. And so this started me on the path. I'm in a master's to PhD program, and my master's was basically digging at the socioecology. What are the social drivers of the Great Salt Lake crisis? Why is it drying up? And led me to kind of doing a deep dive of on the agriculture in the region, right? There's more popular awareness of this now, I think, than there has been previously. But in short, a lot of crop agriculture in the American West, but especially the Utah, is for the growing of hay and particularly alfalfa, which is a very water-intensive crop. It grows very, very well in the region, assuming you have an unlimited supply of water, right? And so kind of digging into that, the political economy of it, what's going on there, is very motivating to me in terms of both fascination and trying to help find a pathway out. And my research currently is trying to expand and generalize this more to the American West as a whole through a couple other case studies. And in terms of dancing outside of sociology, I have popped into geography a little bit to train myself in GIS over the last couple years. So I'll be doing some of that work as well. And incorporating that with those spatial methods, with the historical stuff that comes with political economy and the environment. I also dabble in the sociology of gender for probably obvious reasons to our listeners at this point. I haven't done as much work yet in movements, social movements, labor movements, stuff like that, but that's something else that is another thread I'm following, stuff like that. But that's the work I do now in terms of my research.
It's amazing. I can't wait for your episode.
Yes.
Oh my God, same both and for myself and my journey. My undergrad honors thesis was a content analysis on the Phoenix and Invisible Woman from Marvel and gender representation changing over time. And then my master's, I interviewed 11 young women of color who identified as nerds and thinking about like how nerd identity is typically thought of as very white and very masculine. And the exceptions for feminine portrayals are the thin white young woman with purple hair. So, you know, we talked about like different media representation that was like important or powerful and what it meant to be a nerd, what it meant to them to have these like racialized identities. And the I wish that I had been able to like continue that, and maybe someday I will. Like the little nugget that I started to see was that it seemed like the women who I talked to that lived in urban settings or grew up in urban settings that had a lot of women of color to look up to, that media representation was important, but not as important as for the women of color that lived in more like more predominantly white, right? That for them, having that media representation was more powerful. Like it was just like more important to them. So that was like my master's thesis. I started off wanting to do my dissertation on like gender in the workplace, but switched into looking at gender and our legal control of gender through identity documents. So I interviewed non-binary people about the, like, at the time, brand new, like their gender option. And, you know, that has evolved so quickly. And I captured these interviews prior to Trump's second election. And there was like this little bit of like hope and, you know, thinking about like identity and place and a desire to make change. So I ended up interviewing mostly white participants, and a lot of them were very aware of race issues and really wanted to use their like white privilege to challenge like gender norms. And so like talking about all of those like intersections. So I feel like there's a lot of connections with some of y'all's research, particularly yours, Michelle. But I'm really interested in this like tension between like working with with the systems that we have to make change and working at, like, for revolution in the law and society realm it's working with or against. But, like, yeah, how much are we, like, pushing back and trying to, like, completely change because they both want the same thing, which is more liberation, more equity, you know, like a better life for everybody. But, like, how do we actually manage that tension? And then I've been on other research projects. I've done research in VA and suicide prevention. I've done research projects on wage theft, on legal needs. I feel like there might be something else that I'm missing, but yeah, I have sort of this like broad spectrum of other research that I've done outside of my own research. But yeah, interested to continue thinking about, like, because laws are shaped by people. And it was like non-binary people were behind and trans people were behind shaping these laws and working with these systems. So, like, how do we think about, like, working within the systems that we have and sort of that practicality and just working between those two narratives?
I just assigned, I did a co-class with one of my colleagues who's incredible, and she does a lot of stuff around disability and disability justice. And there was this legal article that she found, and we had our students read it, but it was about trans, incarcerated trans people using the ADA to get their care while in prison. And the question, right, they was raising the questions of, like, is that something that they should be doing? Why not? Right. And ultimately, it was like, it is a viable option for these individuals. And that is, like, they have to work within that system. Right. But then, I mean, and then you could get into all of the, like, the theoretical things. But yeah, it was interesting. And if you haven't read that, I'll send it to you.
Yeah. One of the things that makes me think of, like, especially bringing up the disability, is that, like, a lot of my participants were also had some sort of disability, think about a third. And so historically, disabled people have had to fight for their rights to access the same state systems. And so I think it's hard when you have, like, these. That's where I'm like, it's these different narratives, but, like, people have different buy-in into trying to access these systems and trying to get this, like, higher institutional support. And so, like, how do we balance and think about, like, the state systems have historically oppressed people of color. They have historically oppressed people with disabilities, but there are people with disabilities and people of color with disabilities who are trying to access this care, and getting state access would be, like, monumental. So, like, yeah, how do we balance that, like, tension between these different, like, identities? Yeah.
Yeah, because these systems that we can critique for a long time are legitimate. They have, like, there are incentives to interacting with them, being within them, getting access to them. At the same time, we're like, what are we inviting people into, right? Like, when we are talking about inclusion. So it is contradictory, and there does, yeah, it's a balancing act for sure.
100%. It's just those contradictions are inherent to it. But I can't wait for your episode when you're not getting out of talking about this more.
Well, no, I will talk about it. I will absolutely talk about it. Yeah, personal lore. And we started to hear Michelle's story a couple weeks ago and made you stop telling us. Because
Oh my gosh, right. Yes,
we needed
finally.
we
The
needed
long
the
awaited.
fresh.
Needed.
Yeah, we wanted fresh reactions. So, live reactions. So, Michelle, you have to start us.
Okay,
What?
well, you can't see it, but Iris is losing it on the Zoom thing right now. And I think it's important that they know that.
I can't. You're gonna have to wait just a moment longer because there's another point of lore that, if you know me at all, like, it is something that defined my personhood from a young age. So I am but a wee lad. I am 5'2 and three quarters with the testosterone. They say it makes you grow a little bit. So now I'm claiming 5'3. But I thought that I was going to be much taller my entire life because my pediatrician, when I was like 4, I don't know if y'all experienced this, but mine was like, he guessed how tall I was going to be, his like estimate. He did that for my sister too, wrong for both, but I was supposed to be 6'2". And so for my little brain, I internalized that and I got a
Wait,
complex.
Michelle, you're not 6'2". You have such 6'2" energy on the screen right now.
Your aura is like 6'8".
Yeah.
That's so real. No, because I am
I'm just
so.
like, wow, this person must just like passively be very good at basketball.
It's funny because I like joked about having a tall person personality for a long time because I internalized it and I hit my growth spurt and stopped in seventh grade and am in this form now. But I thought, and for no reason, I was like maybe I was like 21, 22 inches as a kid, like when I was born. So I was like, maybe that, no. And no one in my family is tall except for my brother, whose mom has a twin brother who's like super tall. Other than that, my dad's 5'8", my mom's like 5'6", like very average. And then I came below average, but whatever. So short king over here. But no, I internalized that, and it's often an icebreaker or a drunken story that I'll tell people because I think it's so ridiculous. But I for so long, and I'm notoriously bad at judging height, so here will be a good segue into the lore that y'all have been long anticipating. But so I've played rugby for over a decade, and one of my teammates, I don't know what we were talking. I think it was just like in casual conversation, but I like was said something about like, oh yeah, like I'm as tall as her. And then she came over me and towered over me, and she's like, yeah, are you? And I was like, oh, I had it all wrong. And then she, so she liked to bring that up, and she's like 5'8" or something like that. And so, and I was like, man, I really think like I'm so bad, like spatially too, of like I always like I overestimate my height and underestimate everyone else's height unless I'm like directly face to face with them. But yeah, no, I am but a wee lad of 5'. But yeah, so the long anticipated I when found out that I played rugby, and so I started to talk about that, and I just casually was like, yeah, until I broke my back. Unofficially retired, haven't announced it. But it was a
Is
big
this
chunk
the
of my life.
announcement?
No, oh,
I think the theme and the name of
oh,
this episode just changed. I think you just announced it. This
yeah.
is first and foremost Michelle's retirement announcement from rugby.
Oh
Yeah.
man, oh man. Yeah, I guess it's official now. But yeah, I played a lot of sports growing up, but like in a way, like again, we were super poor, and so I was like one of the only people I knew growing up that didn't play like soccer as a kid. I didn't get into sports until it was free in school. So I started out with like basketball in fifth and sixth grade, you know, when I was still like close to everyone else's height. And then from there, I like tried all of these different sports because I'm like somewhat, you know, naturally athletic and I like a sport. And so I tried a bunch of stuff. I've done most things at least one season. Like I played tennis a season. I wasn't good. I played softball. But the three main ones that I stuck with, the first one that I stuck with the longest was wrestling. My brother got me into it, so I wrestled for about like 6-ish years. And then I also, at the same time, got into cheer, which like it was very counter whenever I tell somebody that they're like, what? But then like it kind of makes sense with like my peppy sensibilities sometimes. But and I would say I was pretty good at it. But then rugby was my third main, and then I ended up like quitting the others for rugby, and I've played all over the US, like kind of like in the major regions. Being from Idaho, traveled around, you know, like the West, and when I briefly moved to Indiana at 18 because I just wanted to get out of Idaho, I played in Fort Wayne with that team, and then ended up coming over here. Now I've played with like some Ohio teams, and so I've traveled over here for it, and it was a big part of my life for a really long time. And I feel like probably the reason that I didn't formally announce it, I guess, until now was because when you get like so embedded in an identity, and like if it's something like I know a lot of like especially like former athletes go through something. Maybe I think like you know once an athlete always an athlete. But when you're no longer like competing in that, it's like it's a weird human experience. I used to play that. But yeah, broke my back. But so the story for that is I actually kept playing after I broke my back because I didn't know I did that. So I say broke my back, like colloquially, if you will, just because it's kind of easier to understand. But what happened is, so we're in a game. If anybody listening knows rugby, I was scrum half at the time, and I was w in the rucks way too much. So the rucks is when you're contesting over the ball when it's gone down in play, and you're like battling each other to get possession. And usually then the scrum half is like gets the ball out. So, but I was in that ruck. I have since watched the film. I couldn't watch it for like a year or more after because it was traumatic. But yeah, so I was in, I cleared the ruck. I had won the ruck, so the ball was out waiting, for my teammates to come get it. And then somebody well bigger than I kind of collapsed the ruck, like fell on top of me, not in good form. And the way that I bent, so it's in the middle of my back. So the middle of my back bent where it's not supposed to. And I remember like hearing like a popping sound, and then I was just like, it hurt a lot.
Whoa.
And so then I was like on the ground and I was just like, I'm screaming. I was like, ah! Like, what is happening? I was like in shock and I was like, oh my God. So in rugby, the game keeps playing even when people are hurt a lot of times. And so it's not until like the ref like calls it that play stops. And so eventually play stopped, everyone came over and I explained like what happened and I was like, this isn't good. And I got ambulanced off the field for my very first time in 10 years. And yeah, wait.
No.
Yeah, it was wild. It was a scary experience. But then I went to the ER and got x-rays and whatnot, and they misdiagnosed it as a back sprain. So just the muscles. So I got like lidocaine and some, like medicine, and they were like, do some PT. I was in the very next game.
Are you kidding?
No, I was playing in the very next game because I thought it was just a back, I thought it was just my muscles. So I was like, okay. So I did my PT. I was feeling okay. So I played the rest of that season, another season. And then it wasn't until like, I think the summer following that I started to lift heavy again at the gym in off season. I think it was like a squat day. Like my back was like on fire. And I was like telling my coach about it. And he was like, oh, yeah, you maybe like have a slipped disc or something. And he doesn't have that accent. But, and so I went to his chiropractor and got another x-ray. And turns out that they misdiagnosed it. And he was like, often when these injuries happen, the fluids in your body will like rush to it to save, to heal it. And so they couldn't see what it was on the first x-ray. But on the second one, so in the middle of my back, one of my vertebrae is, if that's not the correct term, but one of my little backbones is smushed. So it's a compression fracture on either side. So instead of looking like kind of like a square, it has two crescent moons kind of carved out of both because it just like got squished by the discs on either side. And so there's nothing really like they can do about it. Like I've had a lots of chiropractor work, but I haven't done it in a while, so could use more. But when I first went in there, because it was like a long time that I was like didn't realize what was actually wrong with it, and I kept playing, so I probably made it worse. But the first adjustment I got, he went in and he like was like, oh yes, like right where it was. He was like, yeah, do you feel this right here? It's like pushing on a brick and it should not be that hard. Like it was entirely immobilized. And so my lower back had started to like overcompensate. Back pain is a familiar thing in my life now. And there were numerous like other reasons, and it just like things just came to a head. And I was like, you know what? I think it's my time to not play anymore. But yeah, here we are.
That was fantastic lore. Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Yeah, it's, and I hadn't,
I'm glad you're okay, relatively
thank you,
speaking.
my most
Could have.
major injury. And after over 10 years, not to say like I wish I hadn't been injured in that way, but I had also like over with 10 years of rugby, like I could have been hurt much more. So that goes to say like I had some good coaches teaching me how to like tackle and get tackled properly and all of that. But actually, it was within my last few seasons, I broke my nose twice. And at one point I also like tore my shoulder, but yeah, it was a wild ending. I really like just crashed and burned out of that.
So yeah, I don't know, retirement seems reasonable, perhaps, maybe just a little bit.
Yeah, I think I just kind of like flirted with the idea, and then my gym coach, I said something. I was like, maybe I should retire. Like, and he was like, yeah, you should. Your back is broken. And I was like, okay, yeah, you're right. Yeah, I need to live this life and be able to use my back and any capacity that I can. But I am like weirdly in like transition of like my approach to like athletics and different stuff. But
I seem to have lots of material to riff when Michelle goes. So I honestly didn't know exactly what I was going to share here, but I will just share that I am a good bit north of 6 foot six.
where I was supposed to be.
I mean,
We
I'm
often
six
share
eight.
with
I'll just
each
say
other.
I'm 6'8". And all kinds of things come with that. And I think for that reason, like I've always tried to shrink myself a lot in the world. Like often, like I'll be out with a group or something, and they'll be like, "I can't hear you, I can't hear you," because I'm just always so conscious of how much space I take up in the world. So I'm always trying to shrink myself kind of physically. And when I'm in restaurants or whatever, I'm talking quietly because I just feel like this outsized presence a lot of the times, and I'm not really comfortable with that. And it also just came with other things. Like I was really into studying law in high school and was on like the mock trial team where we would do or in debates and just things like that. I really enjoyed that stuff. I was a pretty nerdy little emo poet kid, but also was into that. And but the law instructor was also the basketball coach and so was constantly
Incredible.
like harassing me to play basketball, and I was just like, oh, I don't want to do, and I ended up turning out, and it was just terrible because all the people who were much shorter than me just ran circles around me because I literally had no coordination. I was just like this very tall, gangly, person, and not, I was way thinner, so I was just like not a lot of muscle on me, and so I just got like knocked around, the court by people smaller and more, stout than me. And then on the other thing too, in terms of the body stuff, I will share that a sibling of mine once dove into a swimming pool head first and broke their neck. And didn't realize that it was broken and crawled out of the pool and got up and walked back to their room. They were on a trip and they were at a hotel. And they went to the doctor, and the doctor was like, "You are lucky that you are alive,
Oh my
and certainly
God.
that you are able to still walk and stuff." Like it was pretty gnarly. So
Wow.
not to just horror turn this into a body horror podcast.
Body horror.
But like, it's a trans experience. No. And then for me, like when I was like 8 years old, we had like these old army bunk beds and like hard tile floors because I grew up in kind of army housing kind of a thing. And so it was like tile over concrete or something was our floors. And so I rolled off the top bunk of this bunk bed, bounced off the dresser and hit the floor and like just broke my shoulder in this really gnarly way. So it would always dislocate. So I have just an endless stream of stories I can share about the most horrifying times that my arm dislocated, including like in the bedroom
Oh no.
on a spicy first date,
No.
which it was just like, what's happening? Like it was just so, the person I was with was just like, what did I do to you? And I'm like, no. And then once I was like swimming across the lake and was in the middle of the lake and it started to dislocate and I had to
Oh
be
my
rescued in a boat.
God.
Once I was doing a rope climb in another country and my arm dislocated and I fell to the ground. Like I just have tons of like
Oh my God.
shoulder dislocation stories. So now I just am so careful with it because I don't ever want it to dislocate again. So academia is the right place for me.
I also, jumping off that just real quick, I had a that one teacher, my first like sociology professor. She actually like years later was like, "You gotta stop playing rugby. You need your head. If like you're gonna do this academic thing, like you're gonna need your brain." And I was like, "Pshaw!" And I got more concussions beyond that. She'll be happy to hear. I'll send her this podcast.
Wow.
Well, congrats on your retirement as well, Iris.
Thank you. No more rope climbing for me.
Oh, I don't know. You here it's like, oh, okay, spicy date, arm getting relocated. I'm like, is that like first date goals? But I don't
Yes.
want Just kidding. This is a sociology podcast. Hi. Hello, listener. Lore. I can go, I guess, although I've been honestly struggling to come up with my answer to this as well. I don't know. Another way my brain worms like to show up is with questions like this. It's just like, I don't know. Am I a person? Do I have stories? Like, I don't know. On the notes of gender and body horror and injuries and the rest, I like to consider myself a success story of recovering from toxic masculinity. You know, maybe that's cocky, but oh, I used to live in some toxic ways. I'm glad I don't now. Yeah, relationship to gender is obviously something that is beyond the scope of this podcast, but I will say that an important part of my gender journey was I kind of just took the gender role I was put into for granted. Like, to me, growing up, for a variety of reasons, there was no alternative, right? I'm watching all of you nod, and I'm imagining is something that can resonate in our Zoom call and beyond. But let's see, went into middle school, still in the late 2000s, right? Culturally, a little bit different now when it comes to things like masculinity and stuff like that. For those who are around then, you will know what I'm talking about. And I very much leaned into the one legitimate way of expressing my emotions, which is anger, right? In lots of ways. And it's funny being on here with some athletes because I am so not athletic. To me, like organized sports. Sports was something that was kind of like forced on me by my parents and my school and by the rest. And I find it so boring. I like cannot because I can't get intellectual like stimulation out of most sports. Although that's not true too, because I tried climbing and that's like really like in your head. And like, I don't know, I didn't stick with that either. I don't know. This is a me thing for sure. But, you know, I did not have like an outlet for my rage in that way. And so I mentioned that like a lot of the ways I got into like politics that's critical of the world and therefore a worldview and then the social science that can be, you know, was like punk and hardcore metal music and stuff like that. So I was very much one of those kids in middle school and high school and so on where like going to shows was my entire personality. And a big part of how I expressed this toxic masculinity was being a little pit warrior. Before I turned 20 years old, let me list the amount of injuries that I have acquired. Growing up in Utah, the Salt Lake City scene was very violent. Still is, but it's not to a lesser extent. But infamous if you're into that kind of music, or famous, depending on how you feel about that. But back in the day, hardcore shows used to be ran by straight edge gangs, and people would jump you for looking the wrong way. And even if there was no sorts of fights like that, it's still just like, you know, moshing is violent in that sort of setting. And so I managed to break my front tooth in half, after which I got what the dentist told me was a crown, but wasn't. So I got scanned by a dentist and I had to have that fixed 10 years later. I broke my wrist. My nose was broken twice. I ended up having to get surgery for a deviated septum. And I think it's contributed to, combined with academia, me now having carpal tunnel. And I think there's one or two more I can't remember right now. To folks who don't have experience with extreme music, broadly defined, this sounds fucking insane. If we have to bleep that, please do. But I don't know, it's a very important part of my lore. Having a way to outlet, there's typical angsty teenage feelings, and then there's, you know, all the additional ick that comes from dysphoria going through the wrong puberty, and then all the rest. And I just found so much to be angry about as a kid. And it was through music that I got to let it out. It was also through music that reinforced a toxic way of both experiencing my emotionality and letting it out. I ended up dropping out of the hardcore scene for gendered reasons as I started to like understand, kind of have a bit of a feminist awakening and chafe against this toxic masculinity, even though long before I learned that it really wasn't inauthentic. I mean, it can be for everyone, you know, for masculinity in general was an inauthentic costume that I was wearing because it was what I was told to wear. And now I've reconnected with this music in a way that's much healthier and is a way to reclaim and express my anger, my rage that is feminine, right? And told should not exist. And so I'd say my relationship to music, to anger and emotionality, being able to touch and feel every other aspect of my being, I don't know, important lore to who I am and the source for most of my injuries.
But and can I just say that if we ever, as a side project to this amazing podcast, decide to start a band, our name be Deviated Septum?
Oh, that's a really good band
Wait,
name.
have y'all broken your
Holy
nose though?
shit.
Win, Iris. Win. We're
What's
gonna get you up to date. No, I'm just kidding.
that? You're gonna
Gonna coordinate.
we're gonna go, like, you're gonna teach me how to wrestle just so that you can break my nose.
I'll teach you how to hardcore dance if you don't already know.
I, like, such a non-athletic kid, was so wiry and uncoordinated and really wanted to be athletic, but, like, didn't have the support or knowledge or skill. You know, it's just time. You just gotta, and I just didn't, you know, I'd rather go and, like, read a book and imagine things. So, like, I lived in my imagination as a child. So that was more my speed and continues to be, I suppose. I haven't had any major injuries. I was gonna say, like, sex is sociological. And speaking of, like, yeah, I did injure my shoulder a couple weeks ago on a first, not a first date. It was second or third date, but yeah, so that same experience didn't dislocate, but just injured. Yeah, need to remember to stretch beforehand.
Oh my gosh.
That's the PSA. That's the
Yeah.
title of this episode.
I mean, I think Michelle, are you younger than Winona?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm in between Winona and Iris, and so it's just that aging thing of, like, weird shit starts to happen. Just you wake up one day and you don't know why that hurts. That is more of the daily life. But yeah, I think my lore is, you know, mentioning, like, growing up super fundamentalist Christian and sort of leaning into it in high school out of, like, necessity, and then coming out of high school, taking years to deconvert, but deconversion and getting married really young and divorced. I
Ooh,
mean,
that's important lore.
divorce, yeah, divorce and coming out as queer and genderqueer, all in the same phone call with people, was quite it. Like, looking back, I'm like, it seems so dramatic from the outside, but it wasn't. I don't know. Like, it is and it isn't dramatic. So it was just that living in compulsory heterosexuality for such a long time. So that's a big part of my lore. And yeah, just again, being a little bit of a fighter, I think it's part of the story I tell about myself. Those are the things that come up frequently for me. Yeah, I really love hearing all y'all's, like,
Same.
stories. Oh, I'm super into music and going to shows. That's also, yeah, pop culture is a huge part of my life, but I never got into, like, the punk scene or hardcore scene. I'm more of a post-hardcore kind of a person. And
Hey, that's also very dear. I can't wait till we can go to shows together at some point.
yeah, absolutely.
This is something I should have said at the beginning of the episode, but every single word that comes out of my mouth, all of my opinions, my perspectives are my own as a personal, private individual, and not of my employer, which I will not be naming nor will ever name on this show.
I think that disclaimer goes for all of us, not any opinions of our employers or our associations. We'll
Dear
see how it.
listener, please stay
Dear.
tuned. Our next A couple episodes will be on topics where we interview guests. So that is what the social eye has in store for you.
Thanks for
Thanks for
listening.
listening to our first episode. Wow.
Y'all are amazing.
Ditto.
You
Thanks.
too.
So good.
Thanks,
All right.
y'all.
See ya.
Thanks.
Bye.
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 We're re rejecting toxic perfectionism.